Hello and welcome to The Laydown, a podcast in which three booksellers from Gibson's Bookstore in Concord, New Hampshire chat about all things literary. My name is Ryan.
I'm Kelso.
And I'm Hillary.
So we have a special guest this episode who you'll hear from in a little bit. But before we get into that, let's talk about what we're currently reading and some books that we're excited about. So I'm going to start. Recently, Kelso and I got to go to an event hosted by the publisher Simon & Schuster. It was down in Cambridge, Mass. We got to meet and chat with six authors who have books being published by Simon & Schuster this summer. And so, yeah, so we got to hang out in a cool restaurant with a bunch of authors and other booksellers and book people and talk about their upcoming books and their lives, and it was great. And one of the books that I was really excited about is called Three Women by Lisa Tadeo. Lisa Tadeo is a journalist, and she spent 10 years interviewing people. And she talked to these three women, and it's their stories, Lena, Maggie, and Sloane. Lena is in a loveless marriage. Her husband refuses to touch her. All she wants is to be kissed. He won't kiss her. They go to couples therapy, and the phrase, "the sensation offends him," is brought up. It's awful. However, she reconnects with her high school boyfriend, and they begin to have an affair. Ooh. And because he is giving her all she wants. She just wants something physical. She just wants to be kissed, right? She just wants someone to love her.
Some intimacy.
She wants some intimacy. And so this guy, he is pretty problematic. However, you are viewing him through her lens of, here's a guy who is treating her the way she, you know, wishes that her husband would treat her. So you have that story. Then you have Maggie, who was taken advantage of in high school by her teacher. And years later, she reports it because she sees that he's won Teacher of the Year at the school. And it's so triggering for her.
Oh,
so she reports
boy.
It. And so it's her story of her going through the trial and dredging this all up and seeing him again. Sloane is married to a man who enjoys watching her sleep with other people. She's really cool and, like, people look up to her. She's gorgeous. She marries this gorgeous chef. They're very successful. They're very happy. This aspect of their relationship, she enjoys it. He enjoys it. You know, this book is so fascinating. The stories are so fascinating because you do have these women who are, you know, exploring their sexuality and things like that. But it's a fantastic book. It's nonfiction, but it's written like a novel. Lisa Tadeo was wonderful. Three Women comes out on July 9th. I do highly recommend it, even if it's not something you would normally find yourself reading. This is so outside of my normal genre of book. And it's interesting to read this because you'll find yourself either relating to one of the women or all of the women, or you'll be reading it going, I know this woman. I know this story. So you'll connect with it in one way or another, and I really, really recommend it. Kelso, what are you reading right now?
Oh, A Brief History of Vice, How Bad Behavior Built Civilization by Robert Evans. I love this book. They have a lot of information in this book about little known and also like well known vices. So you have stuff about marijuana in there and tobacco. You also talk about caffeine. Mm. Some of my favorite highlights in this is Stonehenge as a concert or a rave hall. So one of the ideas in the book was they believed that Stonehenge, the way it's set up, was able to make music and make it loud enough.
Oh, yeah.
Because of the position.
That it's got, like,
tiles.
Cool acoustics if you're in the right spot.
So they also have something in here called Bang, which is a marijuana smoothie that is popular in India.
What?
Yes. So it's fun because I read this in conjunction with the April Gibson's Bookstore pick, Fantasyland, How America Went Haywire, A 500-Year History by Kurt Anderson. And it's basically about how people believe in just these banana things.
Well, his premise is basically like people came to the United States to begin with because they were kind of nutty. And they needed the space in which to be nutty. And how it's only blossomed since then.
Right. But the best part about this book is after you get through like the introductory part of the book, you can really pick and choose what you want to read out of it.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Kind of almost, that's cool.
It's kind of almost textbooky in the way. The
sections.
Right. That's the sections cool. are very short. I do highly recommend this book for everybody. And it's in paperback, and it's 25% off the rest of the year. And we're going to talk about it on April Fool's Day, which I thought is also kind of strange. Yeah.
That's cool.
I think I planned it that way because I thought it was a good date to talk about scams. There's a lot of scams.
Yeah, that sounds so interesting, like scams and conspiracy theories and like the things that people believe. And like I feel like someone might read this and like something that they believe might be in here that, you know, we might read it and be like, that's cuckoo bananas. They're going to read it and be like, oh, well, I do believe that.
Yeah.
But then it's going to be next to something that they're like, that's crazy. Yeah. So that I find really interesting to like pit all of these things in the same framework.
So the other two books I'm reading really quick. So this is an arc I'm reading right now called The 7 or 8 Deaths of Stella Fortuna by Juliet Grahams. It's coming on May 7th. It's a debut novel about two sisters. Stella is portrayed as this beautiful, smart, and tough person who protects her plainer sister, Tina, from the realities of life in 20th century Italy. And then they migrate over to the U.S. during World War II. And Stella is cursed with dying in very obscene ways. It is a family saga about women's struggles in Italian traditions and also about immigration. I'm also starting 5th Season, which is the Broken Earth trilogy.
Ooh.
Because
we
you guys
love N.K. Jemisin.
Because y'all recommended it to me the last time, and I'm like, okay, I'll bite. So I'm going to start that tonight when I get home.
Awesome.
I can't wait.
Hillary, what have you been up to? What are you reading?
The first thing I want to talk about, this is my new staff pick. It is a book about the Irish Troubles called Say Nothing, A True Story of Murder and Memory in Northern Ireland by Patrick Radden Keefe. And it is a remarkable story, mostly about women.
Hmm.
There's sort of these parallel stories. One is about Jean McConville, who is a woman who was born Protestant but married a Catholic. And they were kind of pariahs within both of their communities. And the British have invaded. The soldiers have come in to Belfast. And because she's Protestant, she is really under suspicion. And one night, 8 masked people, men and women, come into her apartment and take her away. And she never comes back. So everybody believes that she was taken by the IRA.
Yeah.
Nobody knows. The parallel story is about mostly one very famous woman named Dolores Price and her sister Marion. Dolores and Marion came from an IRA family. This is the 1970s. Dolores was about 19. Marion was 17 when they become active members of the Provisional IRA, which is the very violent part of the IRA. They participate in a plot to bomb London, and they get caught. And they get put in prison. They get sent back to Northern Ireland to serve out their terms, and ultimately they both wind up getting out of prison. And Dolores says, I will not be in the IRA anymore. I don't believe in this kind of violence anymore. But in the meantime, Boston College had gone into Ireland and said, look, we've had a peace process. We've signed off on it, but there's been no truth and reconciliation. Everybody wants to know what really happened to people who disappeared. So we will promise you that we will keep your archive secret if you will sit down and record with us what happened, and we won't release it until you're dead. And so Dolores Price sits down and does that, as do a bunch of other people.
Wow.
And Boston College holds these records for about 10 years, and when the police in Great Britain find out they're there, they get a court order and get them. And as the secrets begin coming out, Patrick Radden Keefe is investigating what really happened to Jean McConville, and he is able to get deeper and deeper and deeper. The reporting in this book is amazing. He has access to things nobody ever had access to before.
Wow.
And he begins to suspect who it was
who
killed her. So it reads like a thriller because you're trying to find out who this person is. But at the same time, it is all about just the dreadful things that went on in Belfast and Northern Ireland and England at that time, and how people were just manipulated into doing terrible things that they later came to regret a lot. So highly recommended. And then the other thing I'm reading right now is sort of the opposite of that, except it's very political as well. It's a fantasy called The City in the Middle of the Night by Charlie Jane Anders.
I love Charlie Jane Anders.
Have you read this?
I haven't read that one yet. I've met Charlie Jane Anders twice at two different events. I met them at NEBA, New England Independent Booksellers Association event, a few years ago. And then I met them again, Elizabeth, our events coordinator, and I drove down to Boston to see Charlie Jane Anders and another author.
This book, it's being blurbed as, let's see, Andrew Sean Greer, who won the Pulitzer for Less, compares them to Ursula Le Guin. The writing is fantastic. The characters are compelling. You know, they're not just those knockoff, like, cookie-cutter fantasy characters.
They're real
people.
Yeah.
And there's this crazy interspecies amazing thing that is happening here that is seriously making me think I probably should be a vegetarian again. And you have to read it to understand it, but if you're an Ursula Le Guin fan, The City in the Middle of the Night, go for it. And I'll just describe the world to you that it takes place on. It's a planet that seems to have been settled by humans long ago when we had to leave this planet. But the planet doesn't turn. Mm-hmm. It's always so sunny on one side of it, you can't live there. If you step into it, you'll be burned and die. Mm-hmm. And then the other side is always in the dark. And the humans have settled this sort of liminal area right at the edge of that, and live in these highly structured, oppressive society. And it's about these women who are sick of it and want things to change. So I'm only about halfway through, but it's brilliant. I think I found a new beloved sci-fi fantasy author.
Yeah.
So
good.
Charlie Jane Anders also, the earlier book was All the Birds in the Sky, which I remember getting great reviews, and I have not read it, so now I'm going to have to go back and read
that. That's the one I have an arc of. That's when I first met Charlie for, they were promoting that book. And, oh, God. Awesome. So prior to recording this episode, I sat down with local author David Elliott. We've talked about him on the podcast before. He's the author of several books for children and young adults, including In the Sea and Bull. David Elliott has an event coming up later this week for his latest book, Voices, The Final Hours of Joan of Arc, which it's out today, March 26th. So here is that interview with David Elliott. Hi, David Elliott.
Hi, Ryan.
How are you?
I'm good.
Excellent. So for those of our listeners who don't know you yet, you have written several books for children. You've started writing for young adults as well. Your last book for young adults, Bull, was the story of the Minotaur. And your latest book, which is out today, is called Voices, and that's the story of Joan of Arc. What drew you to these stories?
Well, I've always loved, you know, I learned about the myths actually through Scrooge McDuck comic books.
Yes!
I know. So, you know, my family was poor. It wasn't a house where there were a lot of books, but we had a big box, and in that box were tons of comic books. I don't know where they came from. But a lot of those comic books, my sisters had like true romance comics and all of that, but I was like a Scrooge fan. And one of those was called Scrooge McDuck and the Golden Fleecing. And it was the story of Jason and the Argonauts told Carl Banks style, this kind of crazy thing. And, you know, it's great because sort of the illicit pleasure of reading a comic book. I think when I started reading the myths, the real myths, that pleasure came back to me. And so I had an immediate kind of drawing to them, although I thought, hey, they stole this from Scrooge. But, I know.
How could they?
My mind's still kind of like that. But anyway, so I've always loved the myths, and I've always loved the myth of Theseus and the Minotaur.
Mm-hmm.
But oddly, my sympathies were always a little bit with the Minotaur, because, you know, Theseus, he's the quarterback, right? I mean, we've had enough of him.
We're done
with that guy. But, you know, in the myth, we understand how the Minotaur is born. We understand the circumstances of his birth.
Mm-hmm.
Then the next thing we know, he's in the labyrinth. So, well, he couldn't have been put in there as a baby,
Right.
So he had to have had a childhood and an adolescence. Mm-hmm. And so I was trying to find out what happened to the Minotaur. How he got there. That was kind of the impetus for that. And then for Joan of Arc, in many ways, I'm the least likely person to have written a book about Joan of Arc. Don't know much about history, and I don't like research much. But I was working on another, after Bull came out, and it critically, it was received very nicely.
Very well.
Yes, which I'm very happy about. So, of course, the way things work then, your agent and the publisher, the editor say, well, let's do another one.
Yeah.
So I said, okay, I'm going to do a fairy tale. And so I was retelling a fairy tale.
Yeah.
And then one night I woke up and this is a little bit hard to talk about because I don't want to sensationalize it in any way. Mm-hmm. I don't try to draw any meaning from it at all. Mm-hmm. But I just woke up and I saw Joan of Arc's name kind of floating in the air in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I knew nothing about her. I think maybe she was French.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Right? The bare minimum.
The bare minimum.
I think she was maybe burned.
Yeah. I can spell Joan. So, like that.
Right.
I didn't take any meaning from that other than, pay attention.
Yeah.
So I then spent just a day or two noodling around, reading some things about her.
Mm-hmm.
And even at that point, though I knew so little, I realized both how timeless and how timely her story is.
Yeah.
So I called my agent and the editor and said, let's hold off on the fairy tale. I want to do a novel in verse about Joan of Arc. So that's how it started.
Wow.
Yeah.
So as you just mentioned, both Bull and Voices are written in verse, which in layman's terms means they're written as poetry instead of a typical prose novel. I know you've used poetry in some of your children's books, so what made you decide to carry that over into your young adult novels?
Well, you know, I'm always trying to do the next thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, and trying to grow just in my own, for my own pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
So, Bull was, first of all, I had this little, once I knew I wanted to write about that, Bull starts with a little prologue of 11 lines. There beneath the palace walls, the monster rages, foams, bawls, calling out again and again, mother, mother. No other sound but the scrape of horn on stone, the grinding crunch of human bone under calloused human foot. So where that came from, you know, we don't talk enough about the mystery of writing and that, but, where that came from, I don't know, but it was there.
Yeah.
But I could not get any farther with the book. I had it for 5 years, and I never wrote it down. I would just recite it. And then eventually I heard Poseidon speak and found the door to the secret garden, kind of. But it came to me in that way, in that form.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you know, the Greeks through Homer and all of the others have a long history of these big epic poems.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, okay, that's appropriate.
It fits.
Yeah, it fits. Yeah. So I'll try it. With Joan of Arc, first of all, part of it was practical because they said, okay, you've already done one novel in verse. It's doing very well. Let's do another. It's just the business of how things work. But in fact, you can't understand Joan of Arc unless you now understand the 100 Years War. Look, if my history professor ever heard me saying that, he would be killing himself. and I still don't really understand the 100 Years War. But I mean, you have to understand the context in which she was born.
Yeah.
That's a lot of dates, a lot of battles, a lot of names, a lot of kings, a lot of courtiers. And I wasn't really interested in that, in writing the book. And so it seemed to me that a novel in verse, which was more spare, I could leave out all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seemed right. And then I thought, well, I kind of wanted to acknowledge the age of her story and how long it's lasted. So then I wrote the book as best I could in all these medieval forms. Some of them are still used today. I mean, villanelles and sestinas and those kinds of things. But they have their roots in Joan of Arc's time. I would not recommend anybody go about writing a book in that way. it was not easy, but that's what I did.
I love it. Do you think having Bull and voices written in verse makes them more accessible to a larger audience?
You know, I've been thinking about the way people read novels in verse, and every book is its own entity. And so every book demands to be read in a new way of reading, or in its own way of reading. So I think Jeff Vandermeer, the guy who wrote... it starts with an A. Yeah, Annihilation. Thank you. He has a great craft book called The Wonder Book. And in it, I think somewhere he says the first paragraph or the first sentence or the first page should teach the writer or should teach the reader how to read the book.
Gotcha.
Which I think that's so interesting.
Yeah.
Or maybe he said it should teach the writer how to write the book, but it's the same idea, right? And so I think with one thing, you know, I think with a novel in verse, there's a lot of white space. And I think the white space is inviting people to take a breath, to slow down. They're not page turners. I think people can sometimes be disappointed because they're expecting, oh, the plot and the next plot. But it really, novels in verse, at least as I understand them, are really not about that.
You talked about research earlier and your hatred of it, but I know that you did a lot of research for Voices. Was there something interesting, was there some fact about Joan of Arc that didn't make it into the book that you just love?
Well, you know, there are many stories about her that are, you know, some may be apocryphal. You know, she heard voices, and in the Middle Ages, apparently it was not so strange to hear voices. The job was not to rid the person of voices, but to decide where they came from.
Huh.
Were they divine?
Right.
Or were they, you know, from Satan? So that doesn't answer your question, but I think the thing that sticks with me about Joan of Arc is that at the age of 13, she heard voices. And then these voices told her that she would, in fact, save France. She was 13. She was illiterate. She was a peasant, and she was a girl. So a lot of things working against her.
Yeah.
And somehow she did that.
Yeah.
She coronated the king. She lifted the siege at Orléans, which, you know, 8 months of men trying to do it could not have done. She had no military experience, and she did it. And so it's easy, I think, today, this is what it makes me think sometimes, that if Joan of Arc were born today, she would be diagnosed immediately, medicated, and hospitalized. And I just wonder, and I mean, I know there's serious mental illness. I'm not questioning that. And my heart goes out to anybody who's affected by those horrible diseases. But I do sometimes wonder if there might not be other Joans of Arc sitting in a hospital somewhere who is never able to follow through on what her voices told her to do. So to me, the real question about Joan of Arc, it's about Joan of Arc, yes, but in some ways it's about the human experience and the boundaries of human experience. And I still don't know. You know, I had so many questions when I was writing the book, and I have even more than I finished with.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Yeah.
So the chapters in Voices, they alternate between Joan herself, other characters, and also inanimate objects like the fire and the needle. Was that something that you planned out, or was that something that you sort of discovered as you were writing? Like, oh, this poem is from the fire's perspective.
Yeah. Initially, I didn't feel comfortable writing in Joan's voice. And so I said to my agent and the editor, oh, I know, I'm going to tell a whole story through the objects in her life. Her armor, her sword, sounded so cool, right? I thought, oh God, I'm so smart. But of course, it was impossible to tell her story in that way.
Without her.
Without her. Because there was no, I needed a single narrator to kind of get through from beginning to the end.
Sure.
And so then I had to write in her voice, as well as the other objects. About the fire, you know, it was very important that she remain a virgin. When St. Michael visited her, according to her, what he said is, be good. Mm-hmm. And I think she took that to mean be chaste, yes. Be a good girl. Mm-hmm. And so, to me, the fire is what did her in. And so the fire was sort of her adversary. And mm-hmm. so I sort of thought, well, the fire in a certain way was also kind of her seducer. Mm-hmm. So yeah. I wanted to get the fire's voice in there because that was the thing that ruined her.
Right. Yes.
But then, you know, one thing about Joan of Arc is that over the years, so many generations have projected things onto her. Mm-hmm. So, you know, she's a saint, mm-hmm. she's a war hero, the suffrage movement used her. Mark Twain, his favorite book that he wrote, according to him, was a biography of Joan of Arc, which he published under another name because he didn't want it to be compared to Huck Finn. He thought she was a holy being. So, and even now, her name has often come up with the Me Too movement. So yes. Every generation seems to find something. And so what I realized is that no real person can bear up under the weight of all that projection, of 600 years of projection.
Yeah.
And so it really made me wonder who she was. And so I felt honor-bound not to project my own stuff onto her, although I'm a writer, so that's what we do. So I was kind of stuck.
Yeah.
So I thought the least I can allow her to speak for herself. And that's when I decided to use direct quotes from the trial in there. So at least people can get a sense of what her real voice was like. So it was a kind of a combination of things. It took a very long time to get the structure of that book as good as I could get it.
Yeah, well, it works. It's great. It reads really well.
Yeah,
and I love having the other perspectives, which you did in Bull as well. I love having alternating chapters. Yeah. Switching gears a teeny bit.
Yeah.
So other than your own books, what are some of your favorite books for young people?
Well, I don't read as much as I should because I'm ancient and I think the only reason I would do that is to see what other people are doing.
Yes.
And so I'm not interested in that. I love all the Roald Dahl books. I love them. I read a lot of Robert Louis Stevenson when I was young, like Treasure Island and Kidnapped. I love those. I still love them. I read those every 2 or 3 years. I still read those. But I think maybe my favorite book for young people is the middle grade book, Tuck Everlasting.
Oh, I love that book so
I know, me too. Whatever book I'm writing, I sort of ask myself, is it as good as Tuck Everlasting? Mm. It never is, either at the sentence level or the structural level or thematically. But it's kind of what I'm always aiming for.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
One of my favorite things about your picture books, your books for little ones, is that you don't shy away from advanced vocabulary. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, well, actually, it wasn't exactly my idea. Beatrix Potter actually used a lot in, you know, and all those Benjamin Bunny and all those have
Peter Rabbit,
all those. If you look at them, they all have some 4 or 5 syllable words in there.
Yeah.
Kids are not dumb.
Correct.
Right?
Absolutely.
So even young kids can handle that. And I want them to understand that that language is theirs. And they have fun with it. You know, in the panda poem and in the wild, I think the word prestidigitation is in there.
So that's good.
I know. Whenever I do a school visit, we kind of talk about that word. And
I
always say, you know, when you go home tonight, just say to your parents, oh, I think I'll go in my room and practice my prestidigitation. Because they won't know what it means. And then they'll have control over their parents. But this is a story from Roscoe Wizzle, which is one of my middle grade novels. It's out of print now, but the word lugubrious is in there. And it's kind of explained in the context of what it means. And for your listeners here, it means funereal or very somber. So I got a letter from a father, one of my favorite letters, and he said, I just want you to know, I read Roscoe Wizzle to my 8-year-old son, and now he's going up to every adult he knows. Do you know what lugubrious means? I do. So
I thought, that's amazing.
My work is done.
You've done it. You nailed it.
I did.
That's incredible.
So yeah, you know, I try not to overload it because then it's overwhelming.
Sure.
But in every book, all those picture books, I try to get at least one good 5 or 6 syllable word in there.
Yeah, I love it.
Good.
Awesome. Okay, so your event here at Gibson's is this coming Friday, March 29th at 6 p.m. We're very excited.
Please come. I don't want to be the only
person here. David usually brings food. Please come.
Yeah, they'll be saying, we're going to have a little fortified wine, just a little bit. Michael has warned me, just a little bit, and some cake.
Ooh, I love cake.
Yeah.
Thinking of events, what is the best or funniest thing that's ever happened or been asked at one of your events?
Well, you know, events like these are always a little nervous making for the author because, first of all, you don't know who's going to come.
Sure.
And you don't know who those people are going to be. So I did have one event where a woman came up to me and asked me if I would help publish her book on the eating and peeling of fruit. So I wasn't quite sure what to say. But I think probably if my wife were here, she would tell you the funniest event was the very first event I ever did. My first book was called An Alphabet of Rotten Kids.
Mm-hmm.
It was banned in Spokane, Washington.
Something awesome.
I know, I'm very proud of that. But I'd never done an event before. It was at a bookstore. And it was around Halloween, so they had the kids making sugar cookies, and so they were all hyped up when I got there.
Mm-hmm.
It goes through the alphabet. I said, does anybody, these were kids, and I said, does anybody have a name that starts with P? And one little boy raised his hand. I hope I can say this. And I said, yes. And, of course, I thought he was going to say Paul or Peter.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, what's your name? And he said, Penis. So... So I said, where's your mother? And then he said, you're a butthead.
So
Barbara said by the time it was done, it was like a John Candy movie.
It was crazy.
So I've learned my lesson. My events are very...
Structured.
Yeah, that's right.
Wonderful. See, I mean, you learn from experience.
Yeah, that's it.
Last question. What is a question that you never get asked but that you would love to answer?
Well, I don't know exactly what the question would be, but I guess what I would like your listeners to know is that, you know, when you get a book in your hands, it's all finished, it looks great, but I think, you know, so many people go into the making of a book.
Mm-hmm.
The editor, the art designer, even the salespeople have a huge say. And I guess what I'd like people to know is that writing is so little about inspiration and so much about work.
Mm.
It's just going to the desk every day.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as if I'm tearing off a page every day and saying, wow, I am so smart. It's like, oh my God, can I do this?
Yeah.
So in a way, it's kind of encouraging. I would like people to know that because if I can do it, believe me, anybody can. Anybody can. So, and that's true, like in any endeavor. I think, you know, it's like anything. It's about work. Maybe you have a natural inclination for it. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I think I have a good ear for language, and that helps.
Yeah.
But, you know, the good ear doesn't write the book. It's just getting up in the morning and facing yourself.
Persevering. And
yeah, persevering.
Getting it done.
Right.
Awesome. David, thank you so much for joining me here today.
I was so happy to be here. And Ryan, there were such good questions, too. Thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Once again, Voices, the Final Hours of Joan of Arc is available now. It's out today.
It is.
Yay.
I know.
And again, please join us this Friday, March 29th at 6 p.m. here at Gibson's Bookstore for a fabulous event with David Elliott as he reads from and signs Voices.
Thank you very much. I hope I'll see some of you there. And Ryan? You're fab. What can I say?
Thanks. Again, David Elliott will be here this Friday, March 29th at 6 p.m. to present Voices, the Final Hours of Joan of Arc. Mark your calendars and join us. You can see all of our upcoming events on our website, gibsonsbookstore.com. We have, let's see, what do we got? We got book club coming up, which Kelso mentioned. We're reading Fantasyland. And just a quick shout out, next month we have Independent Bookstore Day. The last Saturday in April is your chance, dear listeners, to come and show your love for Gibson's Bookstore. That is April 27th. We'll be here all day having a little party. We're going to have a carnival theme. There's going to be lots of food and raffle prizes, and we're going to have opportunities for you to share your love of Gibson. So please, please, please come hang out with us on April 27th for Independent Bookstore Day.
Come show us some love. The open discussion project for April, Monday, April 8th from 5:30 to 7 here at Gibson's Bookstore. We're going to be reading and discussing In the Shadow of Statues, A White Southerner Confronts History by Mitch Landriel.
Awesome. You can email us about the podcast at gibsonsemployees@gmail.com. Again, that's gibsonsemployees@gmail.com. Our website, one more time, is gibsonsbookstore.com. We're also on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, and we'll put those links in the show notes along with all of the books we talked about today. Thank you all so much for listening. Don't forget to subscribe so you'll know when we upload our next episode, and consider leaving us a nice review. And until next time, we'll see you in the stacks.